Thank you so much. Isn't that an exquisite song? So I have to tell you, I asked her specifically, when I found out she was going to sing, I asked her specifically to sing that for me today. For some of you may know this. Can we turn the back of the house lights up too? I like to see everybody's face. Some of you who know me have know that I have this odd propensity, especially if your phone number is in my cell phone, to call when I'm filled with love and gratitude, and you're attached to that in some way. And a friend of mine in Tucson, it frequently happens when I'm coming back from Lake Havasu because I'm just so filled up. And a friend of mine in Tucson said to me one day, "Oh my God, I love your calls. It's like drunk dialing, but you're drunk on love." She said, "My sister drunk dials me all the time, and it's nowhere near as fun." So people who don't know that sometimes can think it's a little stalkerish, but but anyway. So I have this talk today has been rumbling around in my head for quite a while, and I've said to the people in Lake Havasu, "Here's the talk title," and then it just doesn't come to fruition, and I call them up and I say, "Nope, they're going to have a different one." So I was listening to this song on the way to work one day, and I just burst into tears because it was the piece that was missing. And so I called Cerise, and after I stopped crying, and said thank you. So my talk title today is "Let's Get Ready to Rumble," and I won't try to do it like the guy in the boxing. You know, it's like who can make that stretch out for 90 seconds or something. But really, the talk is about honoring your desires, honoring your heart's desires, honoring your dreams. And inherent, I always talk about there's some things you have to believe to make this talk work for you. And one of them is you really have to believe that the desires of our heart are put there by God, that they are our divine urge, our divine calling, and that it's really what's ours to do in our life. That's where our heart's desire comes from. And so for me, it is kind of one of those good news, bad news things. The good news is that your heart's desire is put there by God, and if it's put there by God, it can happen. The scary news is to do it, you pretty much have to be all in. You know, in poker, do you ever watch in the movies where the guy goes, like there's some big thing that he's waiting, gotta have this money to like save the world. And he goes all in, and he takes all of his chips and pushes them up to the center of the table. And that's kind of what it takes. I mean, that's what living your dreams is about, is being willing to say, I'm going to be all in. I am going to do this regardless of what happens. That I'm going to live a courageous and brave life, that I'm going to live in service to being brave instead of in service to being afraid. Because what stops us from living our dreams is living in service to fear. So there's a handful of books that are on my nightstand at the moment, or on my Kindle on my nightstand at the moment. And one of them I thought about using for the talk title, but then I thought, if you knew in advance, no one would come. It's a book by Pema Chodron, I love her, and it's based on a quote by Samuel Beckett, and the quote is, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again. Fail again, fail better." And so the title of her book is Fail, Fail Again, Fail Better. But I figured you wouldn't show up for that. But I am going to talk a little bit about the other book that's on my nightstand is Brené Brown's new book, Daring Greatly, or Rising Strong. And it's about the qualities of, both of those books are about the qualities of resilience. Because if you play life all in, you live brave. You live a courageous life. And if you're all in, I guarantee you there will be times that you fall. It goes with being human. There are times when you will be disappointed. There are times when you'll be afraid. There'll be times when you'll be angry. There'll be times when your expectations weren't met. And that's okay. When we live our life in service to our dreams. It still hurts, no doubt about it, but it feels very different from a fall that has come because we have run from our dreams, because we have allowed ourselves to be small, because that's what we do. You know, the dreams, we catch those glimmers of our dreams, and we go, right? You just freeze. There's a part of you that catches that dream and goes, oh, are you sure, God? Seriously? I heard Carolyn Mace say one time, how she knows when it's really a prompting of the divine is when it's absolutely absurd. Right? Then you go, seriously? Are you kidding me? And so because of that, we frequently pull back. We get small. And we don't try. And so because it's about resilience, I'm going to give you the definition. So the definition of a resilience is being able to become strong, healthy, or successful again after something bad happens, to be able to return to an original shape after being pulled, stretched, pressed, bent, etc. So have you ever felt pulled, stretched, bent? I have. It's being capable of withstanding shock without permanent deformation or rupture, and tending to recover or adjust easily to misfortune or change. That's what being resilient is. And I promise you that if you are living a courageous life, that resilience really does go with the territory. Because you begin to look at your life a little differently. I say this often, I remember for a long time in New Thought philosophy, they would say, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? And one of my teachers said, really, for me, it's what if you knew you'd fail and it just didn't matter? It didn't mean anything about you. And that what you were doing was something you were passionate enough about that you were willing to keep going, that you were willing to keep getting up, to have that resilience. So I'm going to try to do this really quick, this next part. So there are some things that are helpful in this process is to understand how our brain works. Now, I don't know, I love all this brain research. I can't get enough of it. I read it, and then when I go, these words I can't grasp, then I go and look for brain research for dummies kind of stuff. So here's kind of what I've gleaned about our neurobiology to some extent. And one of the things is that we are wired for meaning. We are simply meaning-making machines. And this is how it works. Whenever we experience fear, struggle, disappointment, failed expectations, shame, anxiety, anything that makes us feel uncomfortable or it's hard, anything that we can interpret as failing, the brain goes instantly to look for meaning, for why this happens. It needs a container. It needs a context to put it in so that it makes sense. It needs a context to put it in so that we can feel like there's a potential for being safe. And the reason that is our brains are really wired for one thing. At its very core, at its very base, our brain is wired for survival. That's the lizard brain that they talk about, the prefrontal cortex where we have rational thought and all that. That's the latest developed part of our brain. The prefrontal cortex is fight, flight, freeze. And so everything in our brain starts there at that interpretation if it feels like it could be frightening. And it's really, it's part of our most primitive process. And what it really does is it offers us insight into how we have self-protection. So all that's really good when we had to worry about saber-toothed tigers coming to our cave, or marauding tribes from the next cave coming after us to try to take our food or our creatures or our mates. Not so much now. But the truth is, it's still in there kicking around. So it operates on that premise still. And Rick Hansen, who is one of my actually my favorite brain researcher, he looks at the effects of meditation on the brain. And he says, the brain is like Velcro for bad and Teflon for good. And so our job is to do the things, to do some very simple practices to help us strengthen our neurobiology and to decrease the Velcro for bad and increase our ability to stand the good, to help us create some new neural pathways for good. When I first heard him say that, I was like, I don't like that. But as I've looked at it, it's pretty true. So anyway, so here's some other things that are true about our brain. It doesn't like struggle. It doesn't like change. It doesn't like challenge. It hates uncertainty. Uncertainty, bad. It doesn't like anything that feels like it's a threat or it has even the potential to threaten our well-being. So, as a result, it's always looking for ways to make us safe, and that's how the story comes into being. Because it helps us foster this sense of survival if it can frame the event. Now, the brain has a prejudice towards patterns, and that's why it works so well with story, with narrative. And I've talked about this a lot, and I never could remember what it is, so I looked it up yesterday. The Bader-Meinhof phenomena. You know, when you buy a new car, everywhere after that you turn, you see that new car on the road. Or if you think you want a white Prius, everywhere you turn, all of a sudden, there's just Priuses and even white ones showing up all over everywhere. That's the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon. And it's because we have a cognitive bias for these recent stimuli, and then we're more focused on it. Well, don't we teach that in Science of Mind? What you focus on is what you get more of. So, in this brain process, here's the really bad news. Our emotions have first crack at the narrative. Not our thoughts. Our emotions have the first crack. So, here's how it works. I meet Mary in Papke Hall after the service, and she kind of ignores me. And I go, she doesn't like me. Did I do something wrong? Did I offend her? No, she's never really liked me. Well, you know what? I don't like her either. Right? Have you not had those stories go? And then we make up this whole story. It changes our behavior. Our mind jumps on that emotional bandwagon and runs wild, right? And so then our next interaction, I'm a little ticked off, right? And so our next interaction is filtered through. Well, Mary doesn't really like me, and so I don't really like her anymore. And it does. Those kinds of things color our responses. So remember, always remember that your emotions get first crack at the narrative. And so if you accept that and understand that, it's a little easier to step past it. The other thing about how the brain works with emotion is it really doesn't care if it's accurate. Right? It doesn't. Because in this scenario, if I were to see Mary in Papke Hall, hopefully she wouldn't go, oh, that Sue Witter is just awful. Hopefully. But the brain doesn't care. It's made up the narrative. It's happy with it. It thinks it makes sense. And so it goes forward. So when you have those sorts of things come up, don't worry. Your brain isn't at all concerned about accuracy. And actually, that helps us. It helps us, if we can understand this process, to begin to back it all up and reprogram it and make some new choices. Because isn't this philosophy all about making choices? It is all about making choices. I'm going to jump a little quote up here. I have to find it. I just love, there's a Maya Angelou quote that I was going to do later. Maybe I'll have to do it later because I can't find it. It says basically that, and I'll come across it, but it says basically that regardless of what life hands you, we don't have to let it make us small. right? We don't have to let it make us small. It's our choice. That's the joy of what we teach. We teach choice. So there's a great book of Ernest Holmes, and I was talking with a lady earlier out before the service about the fun that having all of or many of Ernest's books on electronic or digital format, because you can do so many cool word searches. So, well, don't quit. I'm totally out of luck if it has gone to sleep. Here we go. I still am learning my way around. Or not. I don't want to watch a video of the Emmys. I want my books. Well, now I'm really going to cry. Here, it's home. Here we go. I'm in trouble, you guys, because I didn't write the quotes down. I left them in my Kindle. So we'll restart it, and I'll just keep moving, and we'll come back to the quotes. So we look at what stands in our way. For me, when I do a talk, I always like to say, here's what we're talking about, and what stops me from getting from here to there. And for me, a majority of the times that we stand away from our dreams, that we stop our dreams, it falls into one of a couple of categories. First is outlining. So outlining used to be really popular. For those of you who've been around Science of Mind for a long time, when we had Science of Mind 1 and 2, and they were each 30-week classes, it talked a whole lot. They talked a whole lot about outlining, and this is how Ernest Holmes defines it from Questions and Answers on the Science of Mind. What do we mean by not outlining or specifying the channel through which our good should come? And he says, not outlining or specifying a channel means we must not look in any particular place for our good, expecting it to come from that source only. We must be definite and specific in asking for the results we desire, but leave the way of its manifestation to the mind that knows just how to bring it about. So how outlining works is we say, okay, here's how it goes, God. No worries. I got this. Right? I mean, how often do we do that? I got this. I got this, God. Don't worry. So I've got a plan. I've mapped it out. And really, God, your job is just follow along. Your job is just, because we teach that, right? We teach, you set your intention and you get to have what you want. Well, that's true. But it works a lot better when you allow the mind that knows how to bring it about to bring it about. Because I can't tell you, you know the old saying, be careful what you pray for? Because when you get it, you might not want it. And that comes from outlining. There's a great book called Ask Yourself This by Wendy Craig Purcell. And it's just questions to ask yourself. It's a great journaling book. It's a great contemplative book. And one of the questions is, how long do you give God to work it out? Sometimes I'm pretty good with that. Sometimes 2 seconds. Right? So how long do you give God to work this out? Oh, hooray, here's the book. Okay, so I'm going to go back to my quotes now. The book is called How to Use Your Power. And from the section, How to Use the Power Greater Than You Are. There is a power greater than you are, and you can use it. How many times have we heard that? He says that in this book over and over and over. There is a power greater than you are, and you can use it. You are surrounded by a creative intelligence that receives the impress of your thought and acts on it. How then will you use this power in order that you may get the most out of life and give the most back to it? There's a life force, an energy, an intelligence seeking an outlet through everything. Everywhere there is life in an active state. It is always doing something. The invisible seems to be teeming with an energy backed by an intense desire to create. So in the Omni that I love the most, that isn't talked about a lot, is omnificent. And omnificent means always creating. So we're made in the image and likeness of God, and we are always creating. We are indeed. And that's the easiest one for me to get out of the omnis, because intellectually I can grasp that somehow my energy can be everywhere present because I can think about my friends in North Carolina and they'll call me or whatever, but I still kind of struggle. This one is simple, because I know that I am indeed always creating. So, it says there is an emotional craving for self-expression in everything. And that's what our heart's desire is. It's our emotional craving. And he says, the lion, the wolf, the dog, you and I, and everything in nature have an irresistible desire and impulsion to create. And so in this process of our heart's desires, I really believe that that's where they come from. It's that irresistible impulsion to create. And the next one. He says, again, our job is to simply believe that there is a power greater than we are and that we can use it. We must come to believe that this thing called life desires only that which is good for us. This is all it has ever planned. All of these other things that have so unhappily been lodged in our minds were put there by fear, ignorance, and doubt. This fear and uncertainty that has so burdened us has been based on the lack of a realization that everyone has a silent partner who accompanies them. Fear is what stops that. So, what was outlining is the first piece. Then the second one is that much bigger one. It's fear. It really is. Fear stops us more than anything. Fear of disappointment, fear our expectations won't be met, fear of what other people will think. I come from a family where what other people think, whew, baby, that's king. That is king. My mother, I remember we were having a very large party. My dad was director of advertising in Oldsmobile. She taught voice at Michigan State. The Met traveling company was, opera company was in town, and one of our neighbors and I and my family were sponsoring this party for the entire traveling company of the Met and all the people who wanted to come. So this is a big party, and I'm telling you, nobody's looking at our house. My mother wanted to clean behind the drapes. On the baseboard, behind the drapes. And we said, Mom, no one is pulling back those drapes to look to see if there's dust on those floorboards, and if they do, to heck with them. But that wasn't quite what I said. For those of you who know me, you know that I have a very colorful language. So we have a fear that we're not lovable. We have a fear that we're not worthy or enough in any level. And we have a fear of falling and not being able to get back up. And that's failure. So sometimes these things are so powerful that we simply stop trying. We fold in on ourselves and we create a narrative about why we don't try. Why we're willing to let our dreams languish. And in the outlining process, here's a part of what can happen. If you, for example, like Mark is doing some exquisite job with writing right now. And if you want to be a writer, and you say, I can't really consider myself successful until I'm on Oprah. And my book is in her book club. It's a fabulous dream to hold, but don't allow yourself to not see the success of your dream if you wait until that happens. Does that make sense? It's about allowing that our good to come to us through sources known and unknown. And if we do that, the world opens up to us in a brand new way. In a brand new way, in a beautiful way. Because this avenue that we thought we were going to go down, if we fall, if it doesn't work out, if you believe that this is a desire that was put in your heart that it's, and you have gone for it because you're all in, because you're trying, then yes, it hurts when you fall. But it is so much easier to get up when you get up in service of being brave, being all in, going for your dreams, than when you fall because you hit. It's much, much more painful. In fact, the darkest times of my life, I can honestly say, were really tied to those times when I knew I was doing something, anything, to avoid that still small voice and its urging. So in the Pema Chodron book, she talks about two general ways that we deal with it, because she refers to it as a visceral and sometimes overwhelming feeling. And we're really not taught how to deal with those overwhelming feelings. So she says, here are our most common responses to fear. We think that it's something that happens to us from outside us. Isn't that easier? It's so easy to go, well, that didn't work because my boss is a jerk, right? Or whatever. You can fill in the blank on how that works. Something outside of us. And how you deal with it, she talks about, we move away from the rawness of holding the rawness of vulnerability in our heart by blaming it on the other. And the other really common thing, which is probably inherent in whatever approach we take, is that we feel really bad about ourselves and label ourselves as a failure. We have this feeling that there is something fundamentally, basically, and frequently, inherently wrong with us. Because when we have something bad happen, it's very easy in this, without having it being brought up to a higher conscious level, to say something bad happened, I'm bad. As opposed to, something didn't work out. It doesn't mean my dream is wrong. It doesn't mean my dream is bad. It doesn't mean I should give up on my dream. It just means look for a different path. Be open to the activity of spirit in that source which knows how to bring it about. So then we say, well, that's great. What do we do now? So what? One of the things, I can't tell you how often my brain goes, so what? Wendy Craig Purcell also has in her book a great question. How safe would it be for others to walk the corridors of your mind? I love that one. And when my brain is going crazy, that's a question that I will ask myself frequently. How safe would it be for others to be in the corridor of my mind right now? They would need perhaps a flak jacket and a little artillery. Because I tend to respond with aggression. That's my go-to position. So she says, what we do with heartbreak of all kinds is to sort out and to pull yourself up or help yourself to hold this to begin to question what is really happening. Okay? Because we have the narrative going and we don't slow down to question, well, what's really happening? If you think about Byron Katie's work, I just love her work. One of the things she says is, who would you be without your story? Well, according to the brain researchers, not possible. Absolutely not possible. But what you can do is create a new ending to your story. But then she has in her questions, is it true? And then I love the next question. Is it really true? Right? Because of course, in first pass, our brain goes, well, of course it's true. Of course Mary doesn't like me. Right? Of course it's true. But when you step back a little farther and say, now, is it really true? Is it really true? It gives us the opportunity to begin to question. And some of the questions that are in Brené Brown's book, she says, questions to help you with recognizing where you are. Because a lot of times we're stuck in the, well, of course it's true stage. And so she says, questions to ask can be things like, why am I being so hard on everyone around me today? What's setting me off? How did I get to the point where I want to punch this wall? although I'm not a big puncher, but she said, dig into the why. Or things like, I'm so overwhelmed, I can't stop thinking about that conversation at work. Why not? I'm having such a strong emotional reaction to this. What's really going on? And I love this one too. I know Oreos aren't going to work. Right? And if you're me, you go, so I know Oreos aren't going to work. So what's really happening? And those kinds of questions that we can begin to ask ourselves is the first step. The first step is to be curious. Because when we look at things, if we simply take them at face value, and in that first question, is it true? Of course it's true. To step back and begin to be curious creates an amazing opportunity to look at life differently. So in navigation, there's a term called reckoning, or as in dead reckoning. It's the process of calculating where you are. And to do that, you have to know where you've been, what factors influenced, what got you there, like speed, wind course, all that sort of stuff. And without reckoning, you can't chart a future course. And so we have to know exactly where we are. That's a part of what being curious is about. Where am I really? And so in that process, I always love the analogy. Reverend Karen's in San Diego right now. So you have to tell the truth about where you are. And so if you're planning a trip to San Diego, and you think you're in a different peace city, Portland, perhaps, you're going to plan a very wrong path. You need to be really clear that you're in Phoenix. And it's helpful not only to be clear that you're in Phoenix, but that you're at the corner of A and B, so that you can find your way. And that's a part of what this curiosity is about. Where am I really? What is really going on? Recognizing emotion means developing an awareness about how our thinking, feeling, and including our physiology and our behavior are connected. It sounds pretty straightforward, but it is frequently not so easy to do. In Pema's book, she says, can you allow yourself to feel what you feel when things don't go the way you want to? When things don't go the way you hoped and wished for and longed for them to go? Sometimes you experience failed expectations as heartbreak and disappointment, and sometimes you feel rage. Failure or things not working out as we'd hoped doesn't feel good, that's for sure. But at that time, maybe instead of doing the habitual thing of labeling yourself a failure or a loser, or thinking there's something wrong with you, you can get curious about what's going on. And here's what she says about that. Getting curious about outer circumstance and how they're impacting you. Noticing what words come out and what your internal discussion is the key. There's a lot of I'm bad, I'm terrible, or maybe if you're they're bad, they're terrible. Somehow just notice what's going on, and that will help soften it a bit. And instead say, what am I feeling here? And this is really an amazing thing. Maybe what's happening is not that I'm a failure. Maybe it's just that I'm hurting. It's just that simple. But you know, we don't like to hurt. We are the most overweight, drugged, in debt people in recorded history, actually, because we'll do anything to numb when we feel bad. So instead, being able to be curious enough to say, maybe I'm just hurting, and I don't have to hustle through to make that go away. So in Brené's book, she talks about the rumble, and that for her is when you get in, you know, let's get ready to rumble. It's looking at those dark times and those difficult emotions that we would rather hustle away. In Science of Mind, we say, turn your focus to what you want, keep your eye in this greater vision. But before that, it says, look the discordant fact in the face. Look the discordant fact in the face. And that's not easy to do, because in the middle of our story, it feels awful. And we just are caught up in the feeling. So that process is what we call around here spiritual bypass, right? Because it's so much easier to deal with our story when it's silver-plated, gold-plated. It's all good. It's all God. And on the other side, we can go, well, this is what happened. But here's the good that came from it for me. Easier to present it that way. That, for me, is spiritual bypass. First, you have to feel it, lean into it, and be willing to live with it. And here's some other questions. What more do I need to learn and understand about this situation? What do I know objectively? What assumptions am I making? Oh, holy man, I love assumptions. What more do I need to understand about the other people in the story? What additional information do I need? What clarifications might help? And here's the tough one. What more do I need to learn and understand about myself? What's underneath my response? What am I feeling? And what part did I play? Because we teach personal accountability, there's always a part of us in the conditions of our life. And here's the Maya Angelou quote. You may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them. And I think that's just exquisite. And if we get that, we can lean in a little easier. So some of you know I have a totally oblivious to pop culture. And when I was reading Pema's book, I went, there's a 70-plus-year-old nun who knows more about pop culture than I do. Scared me to death. Because she referenced Beyonce. Pema Chodron referenced Beyonce. Made me laugh. Also made me, anyway. Sorry. You have to just, what? I get a little crazy. But the song is called Pretty Hurts. And one of the lines is, you can't fix what you can't see. You can't fix what you can't see. So for us, then, the process is to begin to look differently at our pain and suffering. And James Joyce in Ulysses, in the book Ulysses, talks about mistakes. He said, mistakes can be the portals of discovery. In other words, mistakes are the portal to creativity, to learning something new, to having a fresh look on things. Isn't that beautiful? If we could hold our falls in that context, life would be so much easier. And Holmes also says, in How to Use Your Power, I believe with Emerson that we should keep our vision high and hitch our wagon to a star. We should keep our vision high and do everything in our power to attain the goal of our heart's desire. So like Cerise's song, In Thine Own Self Be True, it is about keeping going, no matter what. It's about being all in. It's about being willing to do what I used to think was a Dr. Seuss quote, but it's actually by a man named Bernard Baruch. And it is, be who you are and say what you feel, because those who mind don't matter, and those who matter don't mind. So let's just take all this into a moment of prayer. So right here, right now, in the presence and the activity of spirit that is the exquisite divine, it is the exquisite divine that places those dreams in our heart. It places the ability to achieve those dreams in our path. It is pure peace, pure love, pure joy, compassion, empathy, understanding, clarity, wisdom, that as these things are true for the divine, they are true for me. And I give thanks. I give thanks knowing that no matter what happens, no matter how it happens, that as I live in this position of knowing that I am indeed made in the image and likeness of God, that I am a child of God with the capacity to demonstrate all that is the truth of God, that it allows me to step forward into a new way of being, into a new sense of power, into a new sense of creativity, into a place where we can live at peace with all of the conditions that arise. That no matter what happens, no matter how it happens, that we know that we are connected to this divine source that is desiring to bring us our good. That it is this power for good, that we can use it. And our job is to simply allow it. To simply allow it. To simply allow it. Allow it to bring into our life in the way that is the highest and best. And when it does, it comes with a sense of peace, with a sense of joy, with a sense of harmony and synchronicity. So I allow myself to surrender into that great good of the divine. And as all this is true for me, it is true for everyone here. It is true for everyone everywhere. And I am so grateful, so very, very grateful to know that no matter what, I am connected. I am always a part of the divine. So I give thanks for this, and with a joyful, joyful, joyful heart, I release this into that beautiful synchronicity of love and law that always says yes. I open to my good. I know it is coming to me through sources known and unknown. I see it with excitement, expectancy. And so it is. So, thank you.
Yesterday was your last day of sorrow. This is the first day of the rest of your life, and you can make it even better tomorrow. Everything you need in order to succeed, the day you were born, you were given. You can turn your life around, get your future off the ground. All you've got to do is change the way you're living. This is the first day of the rest of your life. Yesterday was your last day of sorrow. This is the first day of the rest of your life, and you can make it even better tomorrow. Every second you delay takes you further away, and you want to be a winner, not a loser. He who hesitates is lost. If you want to be the boss, then you've got to be a mover and a chooser. You can't afford to wait till your money is right. You can't afford to wait till the sun shines bright. You've got to start from where you are. Make your goal the brightest star. Success always starts in your mind. This is the first day of the rest of your life. Yesterday was your last day of sorrow. This is the first day of the rest of your life, and you can make it even better tomorrow. This is the first day of the rest of your life. Yesterday was your last day of sorrow. This is the first day of the rest of your life, and you can make it even better tomorrow. This is the first day of the rest of your life. This is the first day of the rest of your life. This is the first day of the rest of your life. This is the first day of the rest of your life.
Thank you so much. We are so blessed. We are so, so blessed. So now it is time for our joyful giving. So who is on deck today? Here we go. So there's a joyful giving affirmation in your bulletin, and if you would please read it aloud with me. I live in a consciousness of good. Divine love blesses and multiplies all that I am, all that I have, all that I give, and all that I receive. Thank you, God. So I use the Autotypes program, and I have a little card that I put in because I feel like I need to put something on the plate. So I have an affirmation on one side and a little a Bible verse on the other, and I just burst out laughing when I pull them out randomly. Here's what mine says today. It is safe for me to succeed. All right, so do we have small beings today?
They're on their way down.
They're on their way down. We do have small beings. Good. So in the announcements, I really would love very, very deeply to have those of you who have so beautifully served this center in any way, big, small, one time, consistent, it doesn't matter. If you have opened your heart to being of service to this center, I really do encourage you to come to the volunteer lunch. And it's actually the board and Reverend Karen who will be doing the food preparation. You don't have to do anything but show up. So please, please come and allow us to honor you and to allow us to appreciate you for the gifts that you give. So do sign up on the sign-up sheet out in Packy Hall.